I'm Julie Glenn. Today on Gulf Coast Live, we're broadcasting a special hour from the panel discussion we held at WGCU after the screening of a documentary featuring local Vietnam veterans. Enjoy. It is truly an honor to stand here in the presence of these four men who have given so much for our country. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to lead a discussion about your experiences in Vietnam, what led to that time, and what has happened in your lives since then. One of the overarching themes in any discussion of the past is perspective, and how one's perception of truth shifts with physical proximity and the comforting distance of time. For many veterans from the Vietnam era, there have been decades of silence and attempts to compartmentalize the life-changing experience of being in a war in the jungle in southern Asia. It was a time before we had heard about PTSD. Mental health care carried a stigma that young people of today might have a hard time even imagining. Counseling consisted of suck it up, tough it out, and just try to forget. That was a tempting way to go, though, for veterans who were returning to a country that was bitterly divided about the war itself. It was the first one televised in Technicolor and beamed into suburban living rooms from coast to coast. And now, 42 years have passed since the Vietnam War was officially declared. Many of the veterans of that war find themselves removed by time from the immediate horrors that they endured. And some very brave men and women are now coming forward to tell their story. We are lucky to have with us tonight these four men. We have Terry Brennan, who with the U.S. Army sought to be transferred into action, now a Cape Coral resident. We also have Wayne O. Smith from Naples, who was held as a POW for 1,882 days, more than 5 years, after having been shot down. We also have Dr. Tom Gillespie, an Army veterinarian whose work with service animals spilled into agricultural advice for Vietnamese locals, who now lives in Fort Myers. And we also have Dick E. Carr, an Air Force Major General whose love of airplanes led him to a career in the military before he retired here to Florida. So we just watched your stories on screen, and I want us all to continue that discussion, and I would like to invite members of the audience to come up on the microphone if you have anything that you'd like to ask or anything that you'd like to add to the conversation. The microphone's right there. Feel free to step on up at any time to contribute or maybe ask a question or point the conversation in a direction you'd like to see it go. So on the topic of time and distance, did you find it easier to talk about the war after some time had passed? And I want to start with you, Wayne Smith.
Not at all.
Did you talk about it right out of the gate when you got back?
Absolutely. I was lucky. Some people didn't, but I found it helpful to start talking about it. I remember when I came out, eventually, somebody offered me a job. I flew for Eastern Airlines for about 2 weeks before they went under after. And I remembered, who was it, Walter Cronkite? Somebody came up and he said, Wayne, he says, can you tell us how you feel about losing your job shortly after I came back? I said, yeah, I'm a hell of a lot better off than I was this time last year.
A lot better than you were this time last year, a couple of years ago. So you came out and you were able to just start speaking with people. Did everybody have the same experience, Richard? You didn't. You stayed in the military, so.
Yes. Quite frankly, there were not a lot of people interested. I think America really wanted to forget the war and move on with their lives and what they were doing. It did take me a while to want to go back, and we did so 4 years ago, and it was a real amazing experience. It was the best trip my wife said she ever had because she could relate to many of the letters and so on and so forth and actually see bomb craters and all that kind of stuff. And
so she saved all those letters?
She's shaking her head, yes.
So you got to go and see those with you and take that. How did that feel, though, to be there? Because it's a tangible proximity thing. I mean, I was talking about the closeness to it, and you could feel the heat and the heaviness. I mean, did it take you right back?
Yes, yeah, somewhat. But the overwhelming thing was nobody there remembers the war. They have really moved on. And if they talk about the war, they say, well, you know, there was the French War and the American War. And, you know, that's their perspective. Frankly, money has poured in there since the war. The famous TV show China Beach is now a huge resort. The sleepy fishing village where I spent my first year had 16,000 people in it. Today, it has 400,000 people. The French summer homes that were along the boulevard have all been replaced by high-rise luxury hotels, and the Nha Trang Airport has been so encroached upon you can only fly light airplanes out of it. They took our fighter base that we built at Cam Ranh Bay and turned it into their international airport.
So when you go back and you see that, does it just seem surreal to you?
It does. Basically, you say, why did we do this? But then you have to look at history and the time in the late 50s and the thought of the country and the political environment. It was different from 2011 when we were back, or 2012.
Has anybody else gone back to visit?
Never had any interest in it.
No? You didn't want. So when you left the war, did you think about it a lot? Did you talk about it out loud a lot?
Actually, no. Really didn't. I had a few searing experiences, and I came home, and there was a great deal of anti-war sentiment by that time. This was in 1970, and I didn't participate much, but I thought back over my time, 13 months that I was there, and I really felt that by the time I got there, I know as an infantryman in the situation that I was in, we really only thought about making it through to the end of our tour.
Well, one quote that really stuck out to me was, you're a 19-year-old just fighting to make it to 20.
Yeah.
But somebody said they were talking about a lot of the guys there. But that survival feeling is pretty remarkable.
My brother was in the military intelligence, and he spoke Russian. And he ended up in Vietnam after I got orders to go there. They had the sole surviving son rule, which basically said if one family member was there, the other didn't have to go. And so I said I was going to go anyway for the reasons I explained in the piece. I was really interested in seeing it. And so my brother, he decided he was going to go also. So it was a crisis for my mother, I can tell you.
Yeah, I can imagine.
To have two family members over there at the same time. And he was up in Dong Ha. I was up actually outside of Wei for a long time. So I did get up to see him one time while he was there. But it was an interesting experience, which not many people had.
But you weren't there. You didn't have to go. You had the cush job in Germany, but you just really wanted to go. So what did you think it was going to be like, and then how did that stack up to what it really was like when you got there?
I was an armor officer, and I was a tank company commander in Germany. And when I got over there, I was given a tank platoon. I joined the 2nd and the 34th Armor. Which was in the 25th Infantry Division down at Kuchi, but all the tanks were all separated out under OPCON or operational control, and that's how I ended up in the 82nd Airborne, way up north. My platoon, five tanks basically, was assigned to this battalion of infantry, which operated out of a fire base up outside of Wei, and we didn't do much, quite frankly. Roads were difficult. It was very difficult mountainous terrain, and so we sat in fire bases most of the time.
So as you described, though, some of the people that were in your unit, they were finding drugs. They had time to find that. And was this something that people would have done had they been here in the United States, do you think, or were these the kind of people that had the pressure of being in the military pushed them towards that?
Well, I'm sure that was part of it, there was drugs everywhere. I mean, you could get marijuana or marijuana laced with heroin. I mean, you could get anything. It was a continuing problem every day.
So, Dr. Tom Gillespie, I didn't get a chance to talk to you yet. Did you, when you came back from the war, did you talk much about it with anybody, or did you kind of keep to yourself?
I would concur with this gentleman. People didn't want to talk too much. And you can understand that the last 30 years of the 20th century were the most prosperous in the United States in history, and everybody was busy, you know, and they wanted to forget the awful thing of the war. I'm not sure I want to talk about it now. It was wonderful when Rosie came and talked to me, and it brought back all these memories. But looking at the documentary, I was by far the homeliest guy up there, so I don't know if I want to talk about it.
Well, we're just recording audio today. I'm interested to hear you say that people didn't want to hear it. So nobody really encouraged anybody to talk about it. Nobody had the Support Our Troops bumper stickers back then.
Oh, no. Definitely not.
So now, did it surprise you the way that the culture kind of evolved here in the United States? And when you first saw Support Our Troops bumper stickers, what did you think?
I came home to a pretty much anti-war situation. I chose to not really talk about it very much. There was a great deal of anti-war sentiment going on. I mean, I went back to Chicago. This was in 1970 when I got home. And I really think that thinking about it for the 50 years since I was there, it was a pretty wasted time for us. A war that, we were destined to lose from the beginning. And I think that's a really sad story. It really is. I mean, if we're going to go into a war, we should win it. We should try to win it. And I don't think that we were trying. Certainly, when I got home and after. And, of course, now it's all volunteer service. And, we support our troops greatly from afar. But there's very, very few, a very low percentage of people that are in the military in any branch mm-hmm. today compared to, what it was when... By the time I got to Vietnam, there was 500,000 men there.
Dick Carr, I wanted to get your perspective on this. As a career military person...
Yes. I think the saddest part about the Vietnam War is that we haven't learned from it at the highest levels of government and military.
Absolutely.
We have not fought a war since World War II. Our objective in World War II was unconditional surrender. We fought in Korea, and we didn't know why. And sometime a few years later, we said, well, let's stop at the 38th parallel. We divided Vietnam into 17th parallel just for political expedience after World War II. Then we would not help Ho Chi Minh, who I firmly am convinced was a nationalist. He was not a communist. When we refused to help him, he had nobody else to turn to but Russia and China. Amen. And we went into Vietnam under the theory of the domino theory. We didn't want the dominoes in Southeast Asia to fall to communism. Well, we sort of achieved that, but Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, Syria, you name it, no one has defined an end state. When you go to war, the first thing you do is define an end state. Amen. Where do you want this to stop? Amen. We have not done that since World War II. Yeah. And that's why it's pretty much a fallacy all over the world right now.
I'll go back on a lighter note, and I agree with Dick. We went to the same school, as you probably know. He was in the first class at the Air Force Academy, 3 years at Lowry Air Force Base. Fortunately, several years later, I had 4 years in Colorado Springs. On the earlier question about how we were treated, I came out 5 years after the bombing stopped. 5 years we sat there, didn't hear a bomb dropped, because they stopped the bombing after Tet Offensive 1968, when Walter Cronkite said, it's a stalemate. 5 years later, we're sitting there wondering, what's going on? And we sat there, and finally, B-52s came over for 10 days, and March 14th, 1973, I was released. Because there was at least a commitment, we're going to do something to get these guys back home. Now, when I came back home, he talked about getting spat on. You horrible people that are in the military, they're going to go over there and kill women and children and babies. When I came back, we were lavished. I could not believe how people received us. We had parades in Dallas, Texas. We went to the White House under Richard Nixon. We closed it at 4 a.m. in the morning when it never closes past midnight.
Was that from because having been a prisoner of war?
Yes.
And being so much
yes.
later?
Yes.
And that people
exactly
felt that you
why.
Might have felt like you had
the
been
people
forgotten?
People had a totally different view of people that were incarcerated for up to 9 years. You know, I was shot down in January 68. I only had 5 years and 2 months there. I was like the new guy. I really was. They called me the first guy yelled down the drain in the bathhouse after 3 months of blood and grime. He says, "Hey, new guy, tap code." I didn't know what it was. I heard this. He said, "Tap code, 5 rows, 5 columns, the C and the K are the same." That's how we communicated. We found many other ways to communicate, by the way, but I'll quit with that.
Did you ever catch back up with that semen that you
oh,
mentioned?
Yeah. Oh, sure. We have. In fact, we've got a big reunion coming up pretty soon, so we get together.
I might add that one of the people who said, "Hey, new guy," to him is his good friend, Senator John McCain.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. John was with me for 1 year. Yeah, that's true. We were next in the walls next to each other for about a year of my 5 years and 2 months there.
You mentioned about Walter Cronkite and mm-hmm. his statement and admonition. What kind of impact do you feel like the media had?
Oh, gosh.
On the public perception of the Vietnam War.
The same impact they have on our American public today.
But I mean also...
Same thing.
Well, they had an impact on the war, the perception of the war itself, and then also a perception of the soldiers who were in the war because of the images. That was the first time that we saw those.
Yeah.
Do you think that
created
that...
Created by the media, of course.
The videos that were taken in Vietnam?
The media created the hate that most of these guys had when people came back and spitting on them. When there was a cause for that, he mentioned, yes, we didn't really have a real... end game, which we should have. Let's face it, the communists were trying to take over the South. We know that. But at the end of the day, it was changed to be, these Americans are bad. You know that.
Once again, a famous editor in the 1920s coined the phrase, "If it bleeds, it leads."
Yeah.
And that's why the videos, folks.
So, Dr. Tom Gillespie, I wanted to shift topics a little bit and talk a little bit about your job. So you were a veterinarian out there, and you worked with those field animals, the military animals. And another part of your job was interacting with the Vietnamese and helping them with some of their agricultural animals. And in an agrarian society like that, that's quite a thing to do for somebody. Can you describe for me a little bit of your interactions with some of these people that you were helping?
Well, it was called the Vietnamization of the War, and that was the idea to win the hearts and minds of the people, and it was an agrarian economy, and if you can help a family save their water buffalo or whatever, why you've done a good turn, and I have the most obviously wonderful profession in the world, so it was use in that society too.
How were you able to communicate, and were you able to maybe learn anything about animals that you might not have come across before? Because we don't have a lot of water buffaloes in the U.S.
Right. Yeah, we always had an interpreter, and I saw things there that I would never see in the United States. I think it mentioned the rabies in the documentary, and we have the what we call idiopathic hemorrhagic septicemia in the dogs over there, which was... we now know it was Ehrlichia spread by the ticks, and now it's in the United States, of course, and different things like that.
How long did it take you to gain somebody's trust, for example? So you walk up to a farm. How long does it take you to say, "I'm a veterinarian, I work on animals"? I mean, how do you get that across? I mean, well, you had your translators, but how long did it take for them to believe that you're there to actually help them?
Oh, it's within seconds.
Really?
Yeah, people are the same the world over as far as their... animals go, and they like anybody that likes their animals. So,
well, there's a commonality in the love of animals. I mean,
amen.
So, did you find though that being around these animals and maybe some of these military animals helped some of the soldiers during some of the more difficult times?
Yeah, it was quite touching the way the individual soldiers were attached to their dogs. The sad part was none of them got to come home, you know, because of the different diseases and that sort of thing. So. And then you would see soldiers from the midst of New York City that had never had a dog, you know. And there were just stray dogs everywhere in Vietnam. So everybody, if they wanted a pet, could have a pet, you know. And so that was interesting, too, the bond that you would see there, the human-animal bond.
And then another part of your job was being in charge of food inspection.
Yes.
And so they kind of equated knowing about veterinary medicine with food inspection. Right. Did you procure food locally from local farmers?
Inspected a lot of local stuff, yes.
So like when you would be getting, you know, fresh produce in from local people, you would be the one that would go through and inspect that?
Not me personally, but my men, yes. Uh-huh.
What would you be looking for?
Just that they were following the hygiene procedures, you know, to keep from getting food poisoning and that sort of thing within the troops. Army travels on its belly, that's what they always told us.
So the temptation to make comparisons is inevitable, and it's only human. So do you ever find yourself comparing being a Vietnam-era veteran with being a veteran of modern wars today? Do you ever look and see this support, the support our troops bumper stickers I keep referring to, and say, well, why weren't people like that before? Because war hasn't really changed.
Part of it was the draft. I mean, when I got drafted, and a whole lot of people got drafted. You know, today it's a volunteer military, not only Army, but it's all volunteers. I think it was quite a bit different. I mean, I think the anti-war sentiment that grew up, you know, after 68 and until 75, once the draft ended, people, you know, now the military is where we honor them. There are so few of them. You know, we think differently of them. We they're all volunteers, and they're doing a great job, and we have the opportunity to think of them totally differently than we did in my time. And
we talked a little bit earlier about history and learning from history, and while, Dick Carr, you were saying that there are things that we have not learned from history, one thing we did learn, and I do remember in the 90s with the Gulf War, people were very careful to separate the war from the soldier and to, if you don't support the war, still support the troops. And that was maybe one lesson we did get, perhaps.
Personally, I think Vietnam veterans have a debt to the Iraq-Afghanistan veterans because it was kind of the same thing. You walk through a jungle and there's booby traps and you lose legs and arms, but it was never in the media. It was the killing babies part that made the media. In Iraq and Afghanistan, with the IEDs and the many limbs lost and so on and so forth, it was the soldier who was hurt who made the media and identified PTSD, which had been there in Vietnam but never identified, which is a very, very bad, bad thing. And the help with prosthesis and things like that. They started it, really. But then the Vietnam vets, fortunately, got dragged into it, too, when people looked around and said, gee, there are a lot of Vietnam vets that are pretty bad off.
I understand what you're saying. So PTSD being identified and people coming back from the Gulf Wars and Iraq War and Afghanistan brought that to the fore. And veterans from the Vietnam era who hadn't really spoken out loud because, as you said, nobody really wanted to hear it at the time, finally are able to talk about it in a place that feels a little bit more welcoming.
Well, and it's more recognized as in the medical and government communities.
Well, yeah, and looking for help.
I get help.
What was it like if you were describe to me, if you were a soldier leaving the Vietnam War, coming back to the United States, and if you walked in saying, I need help, I keep hearing bombs, I'm waking up at night scared. How do you think the military would have responded at that time to someone with those kinds of qualms?
Not very well, in my opinion.
I would agree. Yeah, I don't think the military was as in tune with what PTSD is today, 50 years ago, and in the previous wars. I don't think the military really did very much to support soldiers with the problems. I mean, today we recognize that PTSD is a problem. I mean, we've got 22 soldiers committing suicide every day.
Even though we do recognize it.
Even though we do recognize it, exactly. Right. So it's a real problem.
And there's a long way to go. You mentioned World War II and World War I. You mentioned earlier the way wars were fought were different. There was a clear goal in mind, a clear, I don't want to say time frame, but a definite end goal. And then wars since World War II have not had that. Do you feel that that might also have an impact on the individual soldiers when they're finished with that war, looking back on them? Because World War II soldiers, I remember sitting with my grandpa and his neighbor talking about World War II. They would speak about it openly, but they were tough guys, of course, because World War II guys.
Right.
But, I mean, do you think that that commonality, that more forceful, we are going here and we are doing this, makes it a little bit easier to deal with afterwards for veterans?
Well, it's totally different on a military person, because in World War II, you were sent to fight, and you could come home when you won. Yeah. In all the wars since, as some gentlemen said earlier, I just want to live through my year. And that was your goal. And that makes a different mentality in the fighting man.
Yeah, also, in my war, I could tell you it was frustrating, because I was trained to take over brand-new weapon systems called a Walleye missile. Never missed. And unfortunately, they said, oh, we want you to go up on China and knock those bridges down. One plane, secondary target, next plane. We still had fuel, third plane, knockout. Instantly, one weapon, 1,100-pound Walleye missile. They call it the smart bomb. Now I'm talking 1967. We could have ended that thing instantly, knocked down the Dumer Bridge instantly to stop that thing, stop the munitions from Russia, China, through the chain, and they would have no bullets. But we didn't. I just never understood that. That's the thing that just irritated me, probably Dick too. He was there flying earlier, but we had these magnificent weapons, and not to be able to use them for any useful purpose was just very, very irritating. And I was just a first lieutenant at the time, and of course they asked me to go wake up at 3:30 or 4 in the morning and frag, and I said, oh, so they'd send down the targets.
So, wait, I'm sorry. You said frag those snakes.
Oh, that means.
Are you speaking in military?
Yeah, that's when you go out. That's a good point. No, that's when you start with call signs, what the target is, what the route is, what time we're going to take off, and all that.
Make
so the young guys got up at 4 in the morning, and the other guys could wake up at 8, and then we'd take off at 9:30.
You're going deep military. I'm having a hard time following.
Well, the young guys had.
But you're saying that you found it frustrating as a soldier while you were there, that it just didn't seem like you were able to go full force where you wanted to go, where you needed to go.
Sorry, I'm so verbose. But.
No.
If I may follow up on the mindset, too, of having a one-year tour. For those of you who ever go back, visit the Chu Chi Tunnels, just northwest of Saigon. 160 miles of tunnels under the jungle out there. My wife tried to call through one of them, and that was that. She backed out, and I crawled through several of them. But they had command posts, mess halls. They had dispensaries, everything under that jungle. They started it in 1953, and that's the long view of war. They had an objective. And we don't understand that today.
And Terry Brennan, I think you had a point you wanted to bring up. Do you remember what it was? It was a bit ago.
I recently watched and read the book, Ambrose's book, Band of Brothers. And one of the things you really thought about, and they were together. By the time I got to Vietnam, you had soldiers cycling in and out of units every day. And so you never had the cohesiveness. You had these constantly people changing, different people, new people, old people. You know, and nobody was very old. I mean, the unit itself, I mean, I was in a wonderful 82nd Airborne Battalion, first the 505 Infantry. And there was a colonel that was in charge of it. But the people that made up the unit, most of them were coming in and out all the time. And it wasn't the same. it wasn't the same. You know, it was.
Well, and you mentioned in the documentary that you just kind of would not get attached to people because you knew they might not be there the next day because they may get transferred, they may go home. Or something else worse would happen. And Richard Carr, I wanted to ask you, you talked about the need, in the documentary, you talked about the need to teach young people about war. But that proximity is kind of hard to simulate, to put people there and make them understand how war is. We watch it on TV every day. We're seeing it happen in the Middle East every day. How can we teach people the reality of war without having to go and experience it again?
I think you have to reach them in all levels, starting from the top with what is the objective. What are we doing in Iraq and Afghanistan, for instance? And then you bring it down. Again, you talk about units, and then you get to individuals like us who can talk to personal experiences and that sort of thing. And, you know, in my own case, for instance, right before I left, President Kennedy said, "We shall democratize Vietnam." Kind of knew that 85% illiteracy and democracy do not go together. So right then you start saying, gee, does the boss really know what's happening in the world? And if youngsters could realize this from an early age and get a bigger picture, and then, you know, you don't want to start them off with the horror of war at the bottom with the blood and guts. That could go two ways.
I wanted to ask Wayne, when you were a prisoner of war for so long, you told us about the TAP code and all those days that you spent there. How did you spend a day?
Oh,
what was an average day?
You don't
just staring at a wall?
Yeah. Well, that's it? No. 95% of our time was spending trying to communicate with someone. Because if you don't have contact with another American in the same position, you can get very depressed quick. So it was that camaraderie, and we found so many. You know what my name is when I could reach somebody? See that W? Anybody see that? A-Y-N-E. We could talk with our hands. We could talk through our cups through the wall if you had an adjacent wall.
Did your captors understand
that? Let me tell you the real quick one. There was one place where the guys didn't have adjacent walls to communicate, but they found a way to do it. One guy was asked to sweep in this courtyard. All right, there were only 12 of them there. And he says, "I think he's doing the code." Well, all of our captors were always on opium. They were always hawking and coughing and spitting all day long. So all of a sudden, what he did, he starts going, A, B, C, and then, now we always ended our conversations with the letters G, B, U, tap code, hand code, everything. Anybody have a clue? G, God bless you. Every communication. Now, with the, we called it the verbal code, the vocal code. You know how that went? G. That's a G. B. U.
Okay.
And we'll get a Clorox wipe for that microphone. I'm just kidding.
We had to do it together.
Does anybody from the audience have any questions or comments or statements? Come on up and tell me your name first and tell me a little bit of your story.
My name's Steve Goldstein. I'm one of the tankers from Pleiku, 1st to the 10th. And a couple things I would like to say, that drugs were very prevalent. We weren't going to stop it. And as long as the guys were doing their job, I didn't care. And I have no intention of going back. I hate them that much. But I'd like to ask the general a question, that anybody that I ran across that did go back, everybody went to the major cities, Hanoi, Saigon, etc. But nobody went out into the countryside. I bumped into one gentleman who did, and he said the hatred that he found, especially in the north, was very prevalent. Did you go out into the countryside or just stay in the major cities?
No, we did go out into the countryside. And there is noticeable differences to this day between north and south. As you know, Vietnam is 1,000 miles in length. Weather is different and so on and so forth. And the people in the north were colder but not hostile. In the south, they're smiling and happy. And along with that, there is a noticeable change in affluence from Hanoi to Saigon. And by the way, District 1 is still called Saigon, and it still looks exactly the same. Our BOQ, the Rex Hotel, looks the same. The BOQ in Saigon looks the same, same colors, same rooftop garden, you name it. I mean, it just, it's a tourist attraction there.
Even Tudo Street.
And the affluence, for instance, in Saigon, the roads used to be clogged with bicycles and cyclos. It's now clogged with motorcycles, Land Rovers, and Lexuses. In Hanoi, it's still clogged with bicycles, cyclos, and a few motor scooters. So that the affluence is very, very evident. Up in Dao Lat and the Lat indigenous people, we spent some time with them. And they're doing the same thing they did 63 when I visited them the last time.
Well, a couple of things I'd like to say is that a lot of the draftees or enlisted, whichever way you want to look at it, back in our day, a judge told me to go to jail or go in the army. As you guys know, most people don't. The other thing is, about 3 years ago, 60 Minutes had General Ziap on. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but well, the general has. And General Ziap was Westmoreland's nemesis. And one of the big guys, I forgot who, interviewed him. And one of the things he said was, you know, the Vietnam War started in the 30s. He was a young guy, and he realized very early he couldn't take on the superpowers. So that ended up being jungle warfare. But anyway, as time went on, at the end of his interview, he made a comment that he was an old man. He was about ready to throw in the towel, and Johnson stopped the bombing. The war protesters got louder and louder. And as you know, in the other countries, when they get louder and louder, they bring the government down. He was expecting the U.S. government to come down. Lo and behold, you know, we won the war when we came home, at least. We were winning. But thank you.
You're right.
All right, we have another comment. Tell me your name first.
My name's Bill O'Reilly. I didn't write Killing of the Rising Sun. I'm a Vietnam vet also, served as a first lieutenant in Vietnam, 69 to 70. I was a convoy commander, running convoys out of Pleiku to Ben Het, Bambi Tui, all the way. Good. Thank you. But I think, like a lot of us, we were caught up in that time frame. I was in graduate school at Boston College, and we got a notice. We were going to get drafted, just like Terry was mentioning, and we had a choice at that point, either to go in as enlisted or I went through OCS. I applied, went through basic AIT at Fort Dix, and then they called us in one night and said, "Guys, you can have. We're closing all the non-combat schools." And you have your choice of infantry, artillery, or engineering. So I know what infantry is about. and I knew what. So I chose engineering, but I was high enough in the class to go on to my original MOS, which was transportation. And they said, you know, after you were commissioned as a second Louis, you could have any station in the country in the U.S. First year, but you're guaranteed where you're going second year. And I think a lot of us wound up there. But I would say I also serve on the board of the Military Officer Association of Southwest Florida in Naples. I'm a Naples resident. And I would encourage you, because the question also was, how can we educate some of our young people? And our mission within MOA is to try to help the cadets at 8 area Naples high schools, which we do each year, including an annual military ball. But I would encourage, you know, any of the folks that are down here, whether you're part-time or full-time, to maybe get involved. We're an association, Military Officer Association, Southwest Florida, of over 200 members. We meet in season, all through the season, for a dance or dinner.
And you go to schools and you talk with cadets?
And we invite the cadets.
Okay.
We just had a honoring of the top high school cadets out of 8 Naples area high schools, where we gave each of the high schools a check for $500.
Do you get a lot of Vietnam veterans that participate in this and that can help tell that story?
Yes, it's just not Vietnam vets. It's all branches of services. The 5 branches of services are represented, and the cadet programs here in the greater Naples area, as they say, they have some wonderful programs, and that's one of our missions, is to assist those programs and to help the get, you know, the young cadets who eventually will go through training and perhaps to officer school. And I would encourage, you know, folks that are down here, if you want to try to help some of the young people understand, you know, something about the series of wars, you know, this is an excellent group. And, you know, I would, you know, we have a website, MOA.com, but it's of Southwest Florida, based here in Naples, Florida.
Well, it's always nice for people to get involved in mentorship, especially as, you know, they're seasonal and they go into where they have a little bit more time on their hands. That kind of mentorship is very specific to the military world. So I think that's kind of an interesting angle to come from.
Correct.
I think we had somebody else who wanted to make a comment. And you got that on there? The microphones.
While we're switching speakers in Charlotte County, we honor ROTC folks with $1,000 scholarships from all of our high schools for all 4 years, if they stay in school. Same thing, our MOA.
And on that note, I'm on the selection committee for those who aspire to go to the academies, Air Force Academy, West Point, Annapolis. You know, all of them. So I do that for our congressmen and senators. So just keep me in mind. I'll leave a message. If anybody wants, I'll get in contact with you. If you know of a kid that, although today I found out when I interview these kids that I would never have made it to the Air Force Academy, and I'm sure Dick wouldn't have either, because you need a 6-0 on a scale of 4.
I know, it's pretty selective, yeah.
I swear they're really good kids.
Not to interrupt you, sir, but while we're on that subject, I also sit on the boards for Congressman Rooney, Senator Rubio, and Senator Nelson, and for the same board.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that.
All right, my name is Bill Dunstan. I have a question for Mr. Brennan. What was the source of the drugs?
I would say that in my experience there at that particular time, I don't know the source. Drugs were everywhere. Marijuana was there. Heroin was there. So you could get it. You could get it, and you could. Yeah, we were in a built up area when my unit moved down to the area northwest of Saigon, and it was a bunch of villages, and you could go in a shop and buy a marijuana cigarette laced with heroin. So it was everywhere, you know.
Right. The reason I ask at that particular time in the 60s, I was in law enforcement, and there was a lot of drugs coming from Vietnam that were shipped in. My other question is to the general. What would you say would be the advice that you would give to politicians today for the Korean, North Korea and South Korea situation?
He kind of stole my question. I just wanted to point that out.
I have also spent about 3 years in Korea on two different assignments, and it gets worse every generation, as you know. The inbreeding or something. Each generation of leader gets crazier, and you know. There's one thing I learned from being all over the Orient, and that is if you give, they take. What you tolerate from a government over there, be it China or anybody, what you tolerate is what you're going to get. And we have tolerated them establishing a nuclear program. We have tolerated them establishing a ballistic missile program. And we dither. We want China to stop them. Well, is that in China's best interest? Maybe not. I'm afraid we are at the point now where the only way we are going to react is if they do something really stupid, like launching a missile into South Korea or Japan, and then there'll be all hell to pay. I see no other way out of it, because let me tell you, they don't care about their people. In 1989, if you recall, the communist countries had what they called the Friendship Games, which were their version of the Olympics. And Kim Il-sung at the time raised his hand and said, I want to host them. So they hosted the games in Pyongyang. In order to host and feed all these athletes, they announced to the general public that the B-52s were going to bomb them any day now, so they had to give up half of their food, half of it, from every family, to feed the army, because the army was going to fight. Well, it didn't go to the army, it went to the athletes, so they could show them a good time. So, you know, that kind of thing. They don't care about their people at all.
It seems, correct me if you think I'm wrong, that we're holding back because of all the population in Seoul. And isn't there a similar thing in the Vietnam War, Mr. Smith, where Nixon and Johnson were afraid that China would enter the war, so therefore they were holding back the equipment that could have been used to win the war?
It's very possible. Okay. I was too young then to, you know, be at that level of.
That seems to be what's in the literature, that the equipment and everything was held up.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine even then that they would be frightened of our capabilities, right. And we did have capabilities. We just didn't use them. Mm-hmm. But I would think that the Chinese, Russians, or any country that had aspirations to muck with us would have known that. Because we were very powerful. In fact, because of Vietnam, we developed a big arsenal, in both on the ground and in the air. that put us light years ahead of anyone in the world. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we still have it.
Okay, thank you.
Well, there was certainly one thing to answer your question, and that is we could not bomb Haiphong and the ships in the harbor. They kept bringing in munitions and SA-2s and everything else from Russia and China, and we watched them unload the damn boats.
That was really frustrating. Flying over, looking at those SAM missiles on those boats offloaded, and knowing that they're going to shoot at me the next day. It was nuts. Well, as he mentioned, but I actually did witness that.
I was running Highway 19 from Quinyan into Cambodia.
Yes, sir.
And as we were running, I remember to this day, nothing was out there. No disrespect to the Air Force, I really mean it. The pilots came over from Udorn, Thailand.
Yes, where I flew out.
And they flew out there. They dropped the bombs. There was nothing there. And we used to throw our arms up. Yeah. You guys had nothing to do with it. It came from upstairs.
We have another question coming from behind here. And if anybody else has any additional questions, feel free to jump in.
Hi, I'm Dr. Chris Wright-Isaac. I'm the veterans advocate on campus at FGCU, and I've been talking to World War II and Korean vets. You're my generation of veterans. I've been talking to some of you guys as well, and the people in the audience who had some very interesting perspectives. I work most closely with our Iraq and Afghanistan returning vet students. And what I wanted to suggest in following up on your comment, Mr. Carr, about education, we have two things that happen on the FGCU campus you should all know about. One is that the Military Officers Association, of which I'm on the board, supports of Lee Coast, which is north of Naples. Same national organization, two chapters in our area, supports the Veterans Voices Symposium that happens here in late January, early February every year, where we bring together veterans from all over the county, from various generations, and we have the kind of dialogue we've had here today. But we have started to bring in the nursery students at the beginning of that. They don't have the energy to sit and listen to all the stories, but we bring them in at the beginning so they can share the salute to the flag and they can share meeting some of the speakers every year because it was pointed out to us. One of our staffers thought up this idea this year, and it was pointed out that these children will remember that ceremony. They may not remember the content, but it will be enough to spark their curiosity and the history. Mm-hmm. And so when we share these public dialogues and when we air them, we are helping to educate, and I encourage all of us to attend those things. That symposium is open to the public. If you go on the Renaissance Society website, you'll see it next winter. You'll see the exact date and the arrangements, and everyone's welcome to attend that. We have it in the ballroom. And I want to thank all of you for educating us today and all of those other veterans who stood up here with their own perspectives. I learned a lot, and I've been talking to you guys for a long time, and I still learn new stuff.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
That is an excellent comment upon... Oh, we have one more.
Hi, I'm John Flamang. I was a first lieutenant with the Marine Corps 7th Engineer Battalion around Da Nang. We had road responsibility for the roads. We upgraded the roads, built bridges, and did things of that nature. Just a couple questions. I wanted to ask Dr. Tom, what happened to the dogs of war?
They were euthanized.
That's terrible. And I wanted to ask Wayne, there was a big ruckus with Jane Fonda. Do you have any insight into that? Or?
I knew somebody might mention that. They actually put a squawk box in our cells. This is late in the game, like 5 years I'd been there, maybe a couple of months before the war ended. And they would pipe her voice. And she was talking to the guys in the South. Give it up. Da, da, da. And so that was Jane Fonda. So obviously there was no real admiration for Jane Fonda when we came out, to say the least. It was hard to believe, though, that someone in America with her notoriety or fame would actually you know, come to that point where she would get on and be a surrogate for the North Vietnamese?
I think we live in a a little bit different age today. Maybe that's due to Ronald Reagan. People come up to you and go, "Oh, you were in the Marine Corps. Well, thanks for your service." Took me 28 years to hear that.
Amen.
Yeah. Right.
Thanks for listening to our special Memorial Day broadcast of our panel featuring the stories of local Vietnam veterans. A special thank you to all of our veterans today. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith. Our director is Richard Chin Quy. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Special thanks to the entire WGCU team for setting up and providing the forum for our local Vietnam vets to connect and share their stories. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.